It doesn't matter how large you are, Russia, you are not too big to fail. And we are not bailing you out of this. And now you need to suffer the consequences.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Backstory. I'm Dana Lewis. Ukraine. This war with Russia will not end with a ceasefire agreement anytime soon. I mean, the fact is, there are not even any talks underway. Because Russia wants to destroy Ukraine, and the only way Ukraine will survive is if it beats Russia on the battlefield. That means more arms, more sophisticated, heavy weaponry, to push back Russian artillery that outnumbers Ukrainian weapons by 10 to 1. Someone said this week it was 20 to 1. But as we saw in Kiev with the visit of leaders from France and Germany and Italy, Europe seems to understand now that Russia's Putin is intent on destroying Ukraine. Putin has said as much, and his key ally and former stand-in President Medvedev has said Ukraine won't be a country in 2 years. So on Backstory, we talked to two strategic analysts this week. Jessica Berlin is in Germany, on why Chancellor Olaf Scholz keeps promising weapons to Ukraine, but seems slow to deliver. But first, the Institute for the Study of War weighs in on where this war is on the ground. All right, joining me from Washington is Natalia Bugayova, and she is a research fellow at the Institute for the Study of War. And I don't know if you follow the study of war, but it is one of the most credible, reputable, cut through the smoke and the fog and get an understanding of what's really happening on the ground in Ukraine. Natalia, I found it immensely helpful, although there is still the fog of war on that battlefield.
No, absolutely. Great to be here. Looking forward to the discussion.
I've just read your article in Foreign Policy. So I just wanted to read a little excerpt from it because I find it quite enlightening. And it really serves as kind of a guide and a map of what we're talking about. But you said that Russia's control in the southeast would constitute a permanent threat to Ukraine's sovereignty and survival. It would subject the people there to perpetual Russian atrocities. It would threaten Moldova, the Black Sea, NATO. It would make any scenario to end this war costlier in terms of lives and resources. The window to expel Russia is now.
Well, actually, I'll start by saying that Russia's intent regarding Ukraine hasn't changed. It remains control. And I think a lot of the risks to Ukraine from Russia digging in the southeast come precisely from that. If Russia is allowed to stay, it will attack again the moment it assesses another opportunity to do so. And secondly, it is crucial to remember that stopping, the fighting there will not stop the killing on the occupied territories. And literally everyone will be subject to atrocities as they are now. Ukraine consistently has scaled down Russia's objectives, operational aims since February. Ukraine has forced Russia to pull back from Kiev. It won the Battle of Kharkiv. And when Russia defined down its goal to take full control over Luhansk and Donetsk region, Ukraine prevented Russia from doing so rapidly. And yes, I know we see a lot of reports from Severodonetsk and the losses that Russia is inflicting on Ukraine, which are horrific, but it's doing so only because it concentrated its forces for the first time since February in that pocket. And it's not clear to me that it can sustain this level of force projection over time.
All right, that's really important what you're talking about, right? Because you're talking about, you refer to combat power and that Russia is approaching the limits of its combat power. What do you mean by that?
Well, first, once again, the reason that Russia is advancing and inflicting such casualties on Ukraine and Severodonetsk is because it concentrated what it had in that area. This is a very grinding battle, which will also exhaust Russians. And there is a risk that they will actually, for Russians, that they will culminate, their offensive will culminate shortly after this battle, because it's hard to sustain. Third, Russia has problems, and it's actually going to be the biggest challenge for them, one of the biggest, at least throughout this war, is generating new combat-capable manpower. They've already tried to recruit and bring manpower from any possible place they had, short of calling for full-on mobilization, which Putin still hasn't done. So in the short time, there are limits on what Russia can do to significantly expand its combat-capable manpower. And if Ukraine is able to continue its defense with support of the West that is required, that's required at larger scale, then Ukraine, with time, will have a chance to counteroffend.
Is not the seizure of Severodonetsk, despite, you know, all of the concentration of Western help to Ukraine as well, doesn't it represent a victory for Russia and a pretty major setback for Ukraine?
I would say that Russia is likely overemphasizing the importance of Severodonetsk, in part because it needs to present some victory for its population. In fact, you know, if we actually look at Russia's domestic situation,
we said that about Mariupol as well, though.
Correct. But again, Ukraine, I think, is correctly prioritizing launching a limited counteroffensive in the southeast, and south constitutes a lot more strategic ground for both Ukraine and Russia. And Ukraine can still win this war if it loses Severodonetsk, once again, because Russia's offensive will likely culminate after this battle or shortly after this battle. Russia is trying to still advance towards Slavyansk, and I think that will be likely the next battle is trying to, as Russia is coming at Slavyansk from both Lyman and Izum area. But again, it's still within the confines of Donetsk and Luhansk region. And yes, it can present it as optics and a victory for Russian domestic population, but Ukraine can still win this war even if it loses those territories.
Show me where it is. Like, because Russia continues to advance. And even though, yes, they pushed forces back from Kiev, they pushed forces back from Kharkiv and launched counteroffensive there. They were unable to push them back out of Mariupol and now Severodonetsk. And I mean, it just seems that the Russians just keep on coming.
Yes. Well, again, Russia does not have an infinite supply of combat-capable manpower. And it might be able to take Severodonetsk, which I think is likely. However, it won't have resources to take any major city, maybe with exception of some areas in Donetsk region after that. And if Ukraine holds on, and if the West continues to supply Ukraine with advanced weapons system, Ukraine will have a chance to counterattack.
And in will you comment, sorry to jump in, because you keep talking about, you know, as long as the West keeps feeding these weapon systems in there. There's been a lot of criticism, it happens too slowly. But then I've also read some really eye-opening information about these big weapon systems, not only getting them there, but the ability to feed them with ammunition it's tons and tons of heavy airlifts through and then on the ground through Poland. And to keep them firing just requires incredible amounts of effort. But do you think when you look at this visit, you know, as we speak, Draghi from Italy, Macron from France, and also Scholz from Germany are in Kiev. These are the guys who keep making promises. And there are a lot of people saying, yeah, but where, you know, show me the money, show me the promises of heavy equipment. Where is it? And it's taking too long. And we are witnessing Ukraine at a critical moment right now.
Yeah, well, I absolutely agree that the West should speed up and also scale the system, the weapon system deliveries to match Ukrainian requirements on the ground. However, once again, the center of gravity in this war, and this, it's critical to remember, is Ukrainian will to fight. As long as this persists with support of the weapons, Putin cannot win this war. And in fact, this is why Russia start to prioritize information manipulation a lot more so now, precisely because it knows this very simple fact. In Battle of Severodonetsk, as actually my colleague Fred Kagan wrote, it is an information operation that it's intended to do just that, try to break Ukraine's will to fight and also try to shake the support of the West and create a friction between Ukraine and the West. It is an information operation to project the power that Russia is unlikely to sustain. And, you know, we can talk about Russia's domestic situation as well, and the fact that while a lot of Russians are, in fact, increasingly supporting this war rhetorically, it does not mean that they're ready to go fight and die in. And there is a big gap between that perception and reality, and the reality matters more for Russia's ability to sustain this war.
You seem to make the case that Russia has kind of pulled on, without going to, towards a full mobilization, Russia's kind of out of everything it had in its pockets in terms of drawing in, you know, guns for hire, forces from Syria. They just don't have much left to draw on.
That is correct. And I think, and they're also trying to forcibly conscript people from the areas that Russia occupies. But again, it's unlikely to substantially increase Russia's combat capable manpower on the ground. Russia is trying to expand the limits from of the pool from which it can draw. You know, there was discussion of increasing the age from 40 to 49. There is a discussion of reducing both medical and service requirements for people to fight in motorized units. So it's trying, but it's trying to expand the pool on the margins. Russia does have advantage now in the firepower, and that is very clear. However, Russia also has the risk here in the medium to long term. It's precisely the fact that it doesn't have, I think, sufficient advanced electronics to maintain some of its defense industrial complex production. Now, it is a longer term challenge that does not change the reality of this very second, but it is a factor nevertheless that will continue degrading Russia's military capability.
Natalia, what about Ukraine? I mean, they are experiencing 100 to 200 KIA a day. I mean, can they sustain all of this? We talk about Russia sustaining.
Look, I think it's only Ukraine and Ukraine's armed forces can decide how much pain and fighting they can take, not the politicians, and certainly not the outside actors who are sometimes trying to volunteer Ukrainian sovereignty on its behalf. Right now, Ukrainian armed forces are continuing to fight. There are taking heavy casualties in the east. That is very clear. However, their will seems to be unshakable. And once again, as long as it stays that way, and as long as West supports that, Ukraine will win this war. The question is, you know, at what cost? And I think this is where the West's mission should be, to ensure that Ukraine does at a lower cost and in a shorter time frame.
What if Putin just turns around and annexes the ground that he's taken? He says, you know, the Donbass, the land bridge, it's mine. I've got it. We're annexing it. And that now becomes part of Russia, just as he did in 2014. With Crimea, can he hold the ground? I mean, does this end then? Does Ukraine be put in a position of having to negotiate a ceasefire and then get into a long protracted conflict like they were after 2014 in the Donbass? Or do you think that Putin couldn't hold that ground and Ukraine wouldn't give it to them and wouldn't quit? The war wouldn't stop.
Yeah, no, it's an excellent question. So first of all, yes, Russia is in fact setting very active conditions for annexation of the occupied territories. And I think that's one of the reasons why there is a sense of urgency to try to expel them, especially from the southeast. I do not think it will end there, precisely because the goals haven't changed for Russia, for Putin. And I think our planning assumption should be that Putin's successor will inherit some of these goals until we see indication otherwise. Therefore, there are no short-term off-ramps in this war. And if Russia is able to annex the territory, it will definitely establish a permanent military foothold there from which it will threaten, you know, Ukraine whenever it assesses a good moment to do so. I do think that the risk of a premature ceasefire is a risk for Ukraine because, you know, Putin, if the offensive is going poorly for him in the East compared to his objectives, he may decide to use a ceasefire offer to try to break Ukraine's momentum, to try to freeze the front line in the best possible configuration he can hope for in this war. And most importantly, break this information focus on Ukraine that it is right now through some sort of a peace deal or ceasefire.
Yeah, yeah. And that's key now because you have France and Germany and Italy, you know, to keep talking about negotiations. And Macron's under a lot of criticism here in Europe that he is pushing Ukraine back to the table. Maybe for his own political purposes, but it doesn't serve Ukraine's long-term interests. And so it's you have all of that politics playing in, and then you have elections in America. And, you know, everybody's saying this grand allegiance. Maybe you scratch the surface and there are a lot of cracks appearing, and that is not boding well if this conflict is a long-term conflict for Ukraine.
Yeah, I think the question about the perception and the information operations that are targeting precisely this, it's the partnership between Ukraine and Western countries, is very core. And look, Putin has advanced some of his goals in the past simply by manipulating perception without altering the reality substantially. And it's part of his offset strategy because the limited, you know, the power base that he has is rather limited, and it's actually becoming more limited. So he needs...
Why do you say that? Why does Putin have a limited power base? I mean, he seems pretty strong.
I mean, I think Russia has, as a country, actually several limited bases of power even before February 2014. They had niche capabilities in the military area. Of course, they have nukes, they have veto in the UN Security Council, some influence over the world through energy, but that was pretty much it. And I think in many cases, Putin has achieved objectives by amplifying those limited bases of power with information operations, with creating perception to project the power of Russia beyond what it truly is. And this war is calling it in question even more. In fact, I think if we look longer term, there will be a question of what value Russia has, value proposition Russia has to its partners around the world, what leverage it will hold, because right now it is on the track to substantially degrade its military capability, not only in terms of manpower, but in terms of equipment. I'm not sure what Russia will be able to sell to its partners from the standpoint of military defense industrial complex over the long time. So just bringing it back to this moment, this is why Putin is trying to inflict the maximum casualties around Severodonetsk to break the will to fight of Ukrainians and to dissuade the West that this war can be won.
Is this Putin's finale, or do you think this is Putin's prelude to more?
I do not assess that Putin is imminently vulnerable because, again, there's a number of many Russians, and increasingly large number are supporting him in this war rhetorically. Again, they're not willing to go fight in it in the numbers that are required, but yet they want Russia to win in this war. So there is a gap and Putin has a reality problem. Additionally, look, I think many people expected that Russians would react to Russian casualties in Ukraine that at scale that hasn't happened, at least yet. Russian population certainly did not.
And hasn't been reported openly.
Correct. But I do think that people who are in the circle, either being at risk of recruited or families of those, they do know the true information because they have all incentive to get the truth. So I don't think it's just the limits of access to information. Russians haven't reacted to Russian atrocities in Ukraine, but what Russians did react to, and I really want to emphasize it, is the setbacks of Russia on the battlefield. You know, we monitor Russian information space very closely, and we've seen an outcry in social media when Russian forces were forced to pull back from Kiev, when Moskva's ship was sunk, when Russia had that disastrous river crossing attempt in Seversky Donetsk. And again, while it doesn't mean that Putin's base will instantly start supporting him, but it does challenge Putin's fundamental value proposition and his promise of great Russia to his base.
Final question to you. I mean, it seems to me that you're making the case that this cannot go on long term for Russia because they're just simply running out of guns and running out of people to pull the trigger. It can't go on long term for Ukraine either, because the longer Russia holds that land, the more they're able to dig in, the more they're able to move towards annexation. I mean, it's this critical moment where if the West really wants to see a defeat of Russia in Ukraine, now is the time to break the spine of that Russian army that is operating, however badly it has done so, but, you know, with 10-to-1 odds. Is there a button? Is there a key, if you were to push or turn, that you would say would bring Ukraine that victory? Like, what is it?
Yeah. One refinement, I think Russia is preparing for a long war. Putin plans for it to be a long war. And in fact, he's betting on the fact that, you know, West and Ukraine will just get exhausted. What Putin can do in the long term is continue to take large targets inside of Ukraine. It's just simply, I think, going to be extremely difficult for him to do so. On Ukrainian side and the Western side, I think there are several things that need to happen. I think first, again, reorientation on this part, that this can possibly be a long war, and starting to plan for Ukraine's military needs essentially over the next year or two, and start fulfilling those needs. And secondly, start to reorient Ukraine's military industrial complex onto Western standards. Start replenishing, setting conditions for long-term forced replenishment as well, as again, many Ukrainians are continuing to be willing to fight. I think economy is another critical factor. Ukraine's economy held off for now, but it will become an issue over, you know, in some time, inevitably. And that's another thing that I think West should help Ukraine maintain. But again, if the West does that and continues to coordinate with Ukrainian military to provide them the weapons they ask for, Ukraine will have a chance, in my assessment, to go on the counteroffensive, at least in the southeast. And I think helping Ukraine win the next phase and then reassessing options, that's the way to go.
Natalia Bogoyova with the Institute for the Study of War. Natalia, thanks a lot. I mean, I really appreciate your insight.
Thank you so much, Dan.
All right, Jessica Berlin is a commentator based in Germany who talks often on foreign policy, and not long ago just returned from Kiev, and she's also a visiting fellow at the German Marshall Fund. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, Dana.
So look, just off the top, Russia is progressing. Russia is taking more land. Russia, despite so many commentators saying that Russia is being pushed back, the Ukrainians are fighting hard and they are resisting and they are holding ground, Russia appears to be creeping forward and the allied NATO response, West, you know, Europe response just doesn't seem to be enough. What is your assessment?
Well, that's absolutely right. Unfortunately, Russia has the upper hand when it comes to artillery, full stop. It doesn't matter how hard and how bravely the Ukrainians fight. All that you said is true. They are fighting hard. They are getting ground back. But the fact of the matter is, the Russian military is a steamroller. They have a huge hardware advantage. And it doesn't matter how many brilliant tacticians and brave fighters the Ukrainians have, at the end of the day, if their positions are being bombed into the Stone Age, at a certain point, Russia will gain that ground. And that's what we've been seeing in the Donbas in the past weeks. I'm in contact also with folks in the Ukrainian army and the Foreign Legion, and it's a grim picture. And we really need from the Western Alliance to see more hardware support, more artillery. We need to deliver them the tanks and the guns they are asking for, because otherwise, slowly but surely, Russia will be able to bomb their way forward.
You're saying that it's a grim picture. Is it painted as a grim picture in Germany? And is there kind of, you know, a majority opinion there that says this is in our interest, in Germany's interest, to stop Putin and to, for Ukraine to win this?
Right. Well, there are two sides to that question. So firstly, no, the public here does not have as much of a feeling of urgency and awareness of how grim it is, how dire the situation is. That's not unique to Germany, though. I think that's the case across the entire Western world. Part of it is, of course, journalistic standards and producers deciding what images to show and not to show from the battlefield. So this distance from the war and from the brutal, bloody reality of what's happening to people right now is kept at an arm's length. I think that...
What do you mean by that? I mean, that's a curious
comment. I'm talking about graphic
images. Are you suggesting that editors are trying to not show pictures from the battle? I mean, the fact is, a lot of news organizations don't want to lose reporters, and they're not putting them all the way forward in the East.
That's true. And this is something that's true in any combat situation. You know, how far forward do you let your reporters go? But there is a lot of content, video, imagery coming from the soldiers themselves. Everyone's got a camera in their phone these days. Mm-hmm. Some soldiers are even going into battle with GoPros. So there's footage. I'm not saying the news should be filled with gore and gruesome images that will terrify people and children who happen to be flipping through the channels. However, I do think there is space for a more clear depiction of the stakes, of the horror, without crossing the boundaries of public decency and protecting young viewers. And that's something that can be said in any humanitarian crisis and war situation. I think in the case of Ukraine, this is also urgently needed because, quite frankly, when you speak to people on the street, there's just not a sense that this is happening. This is critical, and this is happening in Europe. For a lot of people, this conflict feels very far away. To the second part of your question around a majority opinion in Germany that this is the right course, I'll disagree with you there. No, there is not a majority in support of what Olaf Scholz is doing and this course of inaction. There are no exact numbers.
Okay, let me jump in there because you're saying a course of inaction. Mm. So we kind of need to deal with that. So, I mean, I think that there was a belief that the German public supported Germany's intervention along with other NATO allies in Ukraine, according to polling. Was there not?
So what do you mean by intervention?
That it was in Germany's interest to secure the European continent from an expansion of Putin, which included painful steps in cutting off Nord Stream 2, for instance.
Well, that's what I'm saying. The German public is in favor of more action.
Right.
The German government has delivered less action than is desired and needed to help Ukraine win.
Okay. Let's if you can help me understand what they're delivering, because every day I read that they're going to send tanks. Every day I read that they're going to send any aircraft platforms, or they're going to send artillery now, or rocket artillery, or radar for.
Right.
And then there is somebody else the next day saying Olaf Scholz never delivers, you know, and now they're delaying again.
Well, here's the operative word.
So is there a game plan there, or why is it so confusing?
Yeah, what you just said, deliver, that's the operative word. Imagine you've got a pizza delivery company and they call and tell you, we're bringing you pizza, we're bringing you breadsticks, we're bringing you soda, but it never shows up. Well, what does that mean for you? It's very nice that the pizza company has made daily announcements for the past week that you're going to get a pizza. But at some point, after the second, third time they say this, and there's still no pizza on your table, you start to question whether or not they do indeed count as a delivery company of pizza. All right. And this is exactly the problem that we're having with the German government. They are making announcements left and right of what they're going to send. But we are almost 4 months into this war, and no heavy artillery, no heavy weaponry has arrived in Ukraine from Germany. Full stop. So they haven't done nothing.
None?
No heavy weapons. Despite all the
deal. What's going on?
Well, exactly. And this is precisely why there is such an uproar across the NATO alliance, and especially coming from Ukraine and large sections of the German public, that this is simply morally reprehensible and also deeply confusing politically as well. The communications coming out of the chancellery have been quite simply a shambles. It started very strong in the first days of the war when Scholz came out and delivered his Zeitenwende speech. This was, it truly felt like a new German foreign policy coming out, coming forward. And I was highly supportive. I was willing to give the government the benefit of the doubt. Also knew that they would need some time to find their feet. But I was, I gave them the benefit of the doubt. I was cautiously optimistic that we would see them step up and do the right thing. However, in the 3 months since, what we've seen is promise after promise go undelivered.
So why? And is it intentional? Is it just political? It's a political ballet there?
We can only theorize, of course. Scholz has kept his advisory circle very tight. Even within the coalition, the Greens and the FDP are in disagreement with his course. So that's a delicate, tight wire as well. But basically, within the chancellery, they are sticking to themselves. They're making their decisions and holding their course. And at this point, I would put forward that it almost doesn't matter what they say. It only matters what they do, because they have told so many stories in the last 3 months. Circular logic, saying things are impossible, then coming out a week later and saying, oh, never mind, we can do that. At the end of the day, though, where are the weapons? Where is the money? If it's not being delivered from Germany to Ukraine so that they can use it now, then it's meaningless. The statements are meaningless. And there's a lot of theorizing going on as to why this is. First and foremost, and most obviously, the fact is that the SPD, the Social Democratic Party of Chancellor Scholz, they have decades of history and close ties with Russia, already going back to the Soviet Union during the era of Ostpolitik, during the Cold War, and certainly in the last 20 years during Putin's reign, of closer ties in business, especially at energy levels. Everyone knows Gerhard Schröder left the German chancellery and went right into the executive boards of Russian state-owned energy companies. Also,
Steinmeier only left those companies under threat of sanction. And I mean, he towed it pretty close to the line. I mean, I think he was going to make even the U.S. sanction list.
He is a disgraced former chancellor. This is Nixon-level scandal in Germany right now. He's also been disowned essentially by his own party. Even his entire staff resigned in protest to his refusal to apologize and resign from the boards of these energy companies. So it's really been bad personally for Schröder, but also for the entire SPD. They've lost credibility on the topic of Russia. And Scholz has made the situation go from bad to worse. If he has good intentions, this is best case scenario, right? If he has good intentions, then at the very least, he is utterly failing to implement a strategy to achieve the good intentions he has for Ukraine. However, on the other end of the spectrum, and what is looking increasingly likely, because Olaf Scholz sees many things, but he's not stupid. If Olaf Scholz wanted Ukraine to be equipped with German weapons and funds to win the war against Russia, then they would have it. All right? He's not stupid. And the German government, as slow and bureaucratic as it is, would indeed have been capable in the last 3 months of delivering those weapons.
Why in an interview did you call Olaf Scholz Putin's useful idiot?
You're familiar with the phrase useful idiot. I didn't invent it. It goes back to the Soviet Union, right? Okay. Yeah, I've got...
Oh, you're welcome to explain it. It goes back to the...
Potentially. Because I've got
KGB term?
A lot of people think of, you called Scholz an idiot. I said, no, I called him a useful idiot, and that's a set term.
Was that a KGB term?
For folks who were basically helping advance Soviet propaganda and Soviet interests without realizing it. You know, people who drank the Kool-Aid, who believed something that was actually Soviet propaganda or a Soviet double bluff, and were advancing the interests of the Kremlin without realizing or intending it. Useful and idiots abounded.
Yeah. And then you've called President Putin a 21st century Hitler. Very strong words to use, and probably especially in Germany.
And I don't take it lightly. This is
genocide. How do you justify it?
This is genocide. This is, firstly, an unprovoked attack from a major power on a much smaller, weaker neighbor based on false flag accusations of protecting the ethnic Russian minority in eastern Ukraine. This is precisely the same sort of logic and faux justification that the Nazis used in Poland in 1939, and also to justify the annexation of the Sudetenland earlier in 1939 before the war had started. So firstly, there's this historical parallel. And secondly, I don't need to go into the details of the brutality of the sheer wanton slaughter of civilians. Cities bombed to the ground, tens of thousands of people dead, torture, murder, rape of women and men, children to old people. It is systematic destruction and the attempt to destroy the people and the nation of Ukraine in whole or in part, which is a paraphrased definition of genocide according to the UN Convention on Genocide. So when I call Vladimir Putin a 21st century Hitler, that's what I mean. I'm not copy-pasting and saying this is precisely the same as World War II. That's not the analogy. But in terms of this intention of the horror, the systematic use of the entire power structure of the Russian state to destroy Ukraine, that's what we're talking about. And if we let this go on, I have to say, the Chamberlains of the 21st century.
I have to say, I'm shocked at still some of the numbers. Like, you know, they've just come out recently with the numbers of dead, they think, in Mariupol, in addition to 500,000 people displaced, maybe 600,000, but at least 20,000 dead. I mean, you have to take a minute to process that, right?
And that's also just the ones they can find. So many casualties, so many murdered people will not be counted because their bodies have been destroyed or buried in mass graves that haven't been found yet. This is the tip of the iceberg. It is slaughter. And I don't say that to shock or horrify. This is the horrifying reality that we face. And if there's one thing people need to take away from this, it's that this is happening right now in Europe, in the heart of Europe. Ukraine is the largest country in Europe. And, you know, I just got back from Kyiv last week. And it's really striking how, in walking around Berlin, catching up with folks, for so many people, the conflict feels so far away. Like it's just another headline disaster on another continent. But this is right here. You can drive to Kyiv in 13, 14 hours. It's closer than from Berlin than Rome. not to mention anywhere in Spain or Portugal. It's only a little bit further away than Paris. This is our neighbor. This is right here at home. And we need to really internalize this in the public so that people understand we need to tell our governments and make our governments take more action. We do not have time to wait and see what happens in August or something like this when some of the weapons deliveries are being projected. We need to move at the speed of war. They need this stuff right now.
Even this week, Germany said that they were going to commit a brigade to Lithuania, just as the Russian Duma member is talking about a possible motion to withdraw Russia's recognition of Lithuania as an independent country in the Baltics. Then Germany has come out and clarified in the most muddy way possible that, well, they're not going to station a brigade there. The brigade may be of German soldiers may be based in Germany, and then they may, I don't know, rotate through Lithuania like some of the other battle groups. I mean, again, it's mud.
Welcome to the German government's communication strategy. It's disastrous. And
all right. Well, you just said, again, you've just said strategy. You didn't say bad communications. You said strategies. So, I mean, they're just talking out of both sides of their mouths, and I guess it's working for them.
Yeah. You know, I like I said, I was willing to give them the benefit of the doubt at the beginning of this conflict.
No.
I was willing to write off some of those mistakes as incompetence and being overwhelmed and trying to find their feet. But after 3 months of this, this is no longer just incompetence. This is systematic. So if they can always point to a statement saying, oh, we said we committed this, we committed that, but then they don't deliver. At the end of the day, this war will be decided by the things that are done and not the things that are said.
Yeah, really good
point. Germany's role in history will go down as having either done something or nothing, and doing nothing directly supports and aids Vladimir Putin. So you draw your conclusions.
Tell me, what do you think of the fact that France, Germany, Italy, you know, they may be in Kiev this week, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that they're coming around to the U.S. position that they cannot impose any kind of ceasefire on Ukraine? Ukraine is the one that will decide what land they're going to give to Russia, if they're going to give any, and that this has to be probably not negotiated at a table right now, but worked out in terms of Ukraine needs to win. Or do you think that France, Germany, and Italy are now pressuring Ukraine to bring about some kind of ceasefire and to stop the fighting, even if it costs them eastern Ukraine?
Right, that's the million-dollar question, and we're about to find out when they get there. I am not optimistic that they've come around to the American line and have decided to go over there as a trio to announce they've changed their mind and seen the error of their ways and are going to give Ukraine everything they need. I certainly hope they do. I'd love to be wrong, but that's not the vibe I've been getting from Paris, Rome, or Berlin. I think they're going together in part to show strengths in numbers and behind the scenes to try to get the Ukrainians to see that some concessions will need to be made. I think that they want to see a swift end to the fighting rather than victory for Ukraine at all costs. And that's highly dangerous because any concession to Russia means that this behavior ended in a net win for Russia. Any concession will allow him to say, this worked. And if Italy, France, and Germany have any sense of historical responsibility, as well as long-term geopolitical strategy left in them, then they have to see that Russia needs to be stopped now before this can spread. Because this will have a domino effect for dictators all across the world. Certainly not last and not least, China. They are watching this, and their entire Taiwan policy and approach will be based on what they see the West do or not do in the face of this unprovoked aggression against Ukraine. So I am hopeful that that the Germans, the French, and the Italians can be pushed and prodded by our allies in Eastern Europe and the Baltics, as well as in the US and UK, to stand up more Also, there were statements out of the president's office in Ukraine basically saying that they will not accept any attempt to influence them toward concessions or a ceasefire. And they kind of sort of gave that parting opening shot to the delegation that if they try to influence Zelensky and his team to back down, that that will get leaked, that will be publicized, and they will be named and shamed.
Yeah. Well, that so paves the road for these meetings where Zelensky is saying, don't come and try to, you know, put me in an arm lock on this. We're not going to surrender any land.
But you know, need their advice. Really he needs ammo.
Sorry?
He doesn't need their advice. He needs ammo.
It's really odd to me that, probably less so than to some people, but the fact that this is really being led by the Baltics to some degree, Lithuania and Estonia and Latvia and Poland have been so strong and so supportive. I mean, the US has and Canada has and others, but that core NATO group in Europe is not looking very muscular. And it's almost like you have an alliance outside of NATO that is carrying kind of the bulk of this support for Ukraine on their shoulders rather than the core NATO group.
I don't find it terribly surprising, actually. And I'll tell you why. Who would understand better how Russia ticks? A bunch of Western Europeans or the people who, over the course of the last 500 plus years, have somehow lived under Russian and Soviet occupation, dictatorship, and oppression? Okay, from Finland down to Ukraine and everywhere in between, these people, these nations, have been colonized, brutalized, and or annexed by the Russian Empire, by the Soviet Union, in some way or another, for hundreds of years. They know the Russians a million times better than we in Western Europe, not to mention North America, ever could. And this has been also one of the huge imbalances in just the NATO brain trust, that the attention and the influence go heavily to the richer nations in Western Europe, who are also coming from this great power history and mentality. You know, our neighbors in Eastern Europe and in the Baltics, their opinions, their warning flags went unlistened to in 2008, in 2014, onward and onward. They've been calling this right for decades, and we weren't listening in the West. Why? Because there's this assumption deeply rooted, I would even put forward, in our colonial histories, where there are two types of countries in this world, conquerors or conquered. And your Great Britain's, your France's, your Germany's, your Italy's and Spain's, we share a common history with Russia of being great powers who conquered other peoples and nations. And there's this carryover, this post-colonial hangover into our thinking, where when we look at China, when we look at Russia, we see a fellow great power that still needs to be dealt with as an equal, whose word is somehow more important, relevant, and powerful than the words of the people who have been traditionally conquered. And the fact that so many analysts and politicians and journalists, not to mention everyday folks across Western Europe, struggle to imagine a world in which Russia is ostracized, in which Russia is put on its knees, is just unthinkable, because they're Russia. They're huge, they're important, and we have to give them the respect they deserve, no matter what the cost, no matter what they do to someone smaller. And that's a subconscious assumption in our geopolitics and also in our institutions. Look at the UN Security Council, that has crept into, unfortunately, the moral clarity that we would need in this moment to say, it doesn't matter how large you are, Russia, you are not too big to fail. And we are not bailing you out of this. You done fucked up, and now you need to suffer the consequences. And that's a banal way of putting, I think, a simple moral and geopolitical reality that Russia needs to fail now. And we need to make them fail. And if we don't, then we will be co-responsible for the deaths of further tens of thousands, if not millions, and the death of a free and sovereign Ukraine if we don't stand up and help them now.
Is there another element here about those people who failed to take action against Russia, you know, when they invaded Georgia, when they invaded Ukraine the first time in 2014, that, you know, they don't want to admit now that they didn't take hard enough action, and that in a way, I don't want to say that they conspired with Russia. I don't think they did, but they were certainly, it's a blemish on their past and the actions that they took as political leaders.
Absolutely. I think a lot of this denialism and this attempt to give Russia some credit, the calls to save face for Vladimir Putin, that he shouldn't be humiliated. What I hear in that is a desire to save their own face and to not be humiliated themselves. Our governments across the Western quote unquote free world for the last 20 years have enabled and done business with Putin's regime to the tune of trillions. All right. And this was despite the horrors inflicted in Chechnya, the invasion of Georgia. You mentioned the annexation of Crimea, the downing of a civilian passenger flight, murdering hundreds of people over the Donbas, and the brutal bombing campaign in Syria, also against civilians. We've seen Russia do everything they're doing in eastern Ukraine right now. And they've done this how many times over the last 20 years? And we allowed it. And we continue to do business with them. We continue to fill their coffers. And so I think there's also, across basically that entire generation of politicians across all parties and all NATO member states, the realization that we let this happen, we enabled this to happen, and to come out now and put the fist down and say, this will not stand, we stand up against this, we will stop Russia now. I think there's a fear of the blowback that would come afterwards to say, hey, you guys are the ones who enabled this in the first place. And how many careers, how many parties would have to go back and eat crow for decades of decisions that supported Russia? And furthermore, it would also cause a reckoning and a require to reckon with what we're doing with dictatorships elsewhere in the world. Look at China. Look at Saudi Arabia. What kinds of billions in business are we doing with other states who are arguably just as evil as Russia? And our hypocrisy at the end of the day is Vladimir Putin's greatest weapon, because our politicians are more interested in saving their own careers and faces than in saving the people of Ukraine.
Well, there's lots of hypocrisy in Russia too. And sure. I think I can understand how people don't want to be embarrassed by the fact that they didn't take Putin seriously 20 years ago. But I think also they can step away from that and say, okay, this time, the escalation, the cost to the European continent, which we have a direct interest in, you know, maybe they could divorce themselves from some elements of Syria, but you can't in Europe. So I think that does and should give them a European leaders all the tools and all of the motivation to say this is in our interest to stop them now, because there's more to come.
Absolutely.
Yeah, Jessica Berlin, great to talk to you. I had heard you speak before, and I'm so glad I reached out to you. I mean, I'm really appreciate your thoughts, and I think your reflections are you know, dead on the money. And I really do appreciate, you know, talking to you. And I hope a lot of people will listen. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Dana. I appreciate that.
And that's Backstory for this week. One note on Germany. My NATO source says, Dana, Germany has indeed delivered a lot of weapons, including thousands of anti-tank and air defense weapons and anti-tank mines and ammunition and other capabilities. And in fact, they've delivered more than France, I might add, he wrote. The big pieces are starting to move, he continues on. Self-propelled 155 artillery, 7 of them will arrive in early July, with their Ukrainian crews, which have been training at the artillery school at Idar Oberstein. The Gepard's excellent tracked armored air defense systems will arrive in July and August, 15 per month. I'm hearing this, and I'm quoting him again, about the IRIS-T air defense system. Scholz has mentioned it. I just don't know any specifics on it yet. So he and others are saying more heavy equipment is inbound from the US and UK and others, and it will very quickly reach Russian artillery positions that up until now have remained largely intact. Soon, they will come under heavy fire. The war is going to intensify through the summer. Thanks for listening to Backstory. I'm Dana Lewis. Share this podcast, and I'll talk to you again soon.